the heart of every computer, every operating system, every program, is an engineer. They may not live the glorious rock star life of your favorite musician, but it is through their efforts that the complex systems that are more and more significant in our lives are able to work. Often, these engineers, as important as their roles might be in the systems they oversee, will describe themselves as just an engineer. Perhaps that's sort of like Clark Kent describing himself as just a reporter. Today's guest might try to describe himself as just an engineer at heart, but I think we'll see he's a lot more than that. Hello, I'm Robert Hess, and I'll be your host today as we talk with Henry Sanders, Corporate Vice President and Director of Development for Windows Phone. I hope you enjoy this opportunity to look at the technology and the person behind the code. Henry got his start at Microsoft in 1988, working on OS 2 and later Windows NT, which was a key turning point in Microsoft's history and its evolution of Windows. It was the core infrastructure and often the networking stacks that Henry focused on. While technically mostly unseen by the casual user, the networking stacks are not only fundamental, but also complex systems that pervade through almost all the internal systems. Today, he heads up the development team for Windows Phone and applies the same drive towards providing solidly built systems to this new and exciting platform that continues to illustrate the evolution of Windows and the applications that run on it. Join me now as I welcome today's guest, Henry Sanders.
Hello.
Well, Henry, you've been at Microsoft quite a long time, it seems like.
Yep.
So to spend that much time in Microsoft and that much engineering work in all the different systems, I'm assuming you probably got kind of an early start in technology?
Reasonably, not as early as some people. I think I started programming in seventh grade.
That's pretty early.
Yeah, especially when you consider how old I am. I think my first computer was an OSI Challenger 2, and my math teacher at the time gave me a book on basic programming and loaned it out, and I started with that. Went on from that to, mostly through high school, played with the school computers. I didn't own my own computer until after I got out of college, and studied computer science at university.
So in high school, what years were those about?
I graduated high school in 1982.
Okay. So high schools, even back then, weren't really fully embracing computer programming yet.
Not especially not where I grew up in Oregon. There were a few computers around. I forget what the models we had back then beyond the first one that I used. I don't think I knew anybody who had their own computer back then for sure.
Mm-hmm. And what language did you use?
We started off in BASIC through then. Was what I was programming in back then, and whatever machine language, simple language stuff we could find for the computers we were working on. College, I went on to Pascal, which was what everybody started on back then. And then at Cornell, we had something called PLC, which was another language, and then later C was what I learned. And actually, I spent a lot of time in college programming in IBM 370 assembly language, which was the main computer we used back then.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And of those different languages, which was your favorite?
Of that set of languages?
Yeah.
C, for sure. Yeah, if I got to choose between Pascal, PLC, and C, and IBM 370 assembly, I think I'm going with C.
And the IBM's not quite as user friendly as as C was back then. But was it mostly on small room computers, or do any of the batch type jobs with the card?
No, in college it was all mainframes, and then I think eventually we graduated to a PDP of some sort, PDP or maybe a VAX also, and I think we had a PDP, mm-hmm. which were still not personal computers. We had a few personal computers starting to show up in Cornell at in college, probably my last couple of years there. That was a long time ago, and trying to remember exactly what I worked on, it's a little hazy, but I remember spending most of my time working on the bigger machines.
Yeah, I mean, so you had more of a terminal, a dumb terminal that you'd be taking interfacing with, and it's always kind of amazing to me is what goes around comes around, because now people are talking about these, thin client machines that are essentially just graphical dumb terminals for the most part.
Yeah, I mean, we've gone back and forth on it a couple times, and there is. I think is interesting actually is the sheer horsepower that's gotten smaller. I mean, the smartphones we carry nowadays are much more powerful in most measurements at least than anything I programmed on growing up. And then it's kind of hard to believe, you know, looking back then that you've been able to do that. I remember having, you know, these big machines out there and, you know, running fairly simple programs very slowly. So
yeah, just playing something like Zork on them took forever, it seemed like.
Yeah.
So, I mean, getting a start in seventh grade, does that mean that your family was into technology at all, or?
You know, not really. I don't remember them being particularly involved in it at that point in time. My brother got involved later. He's a hardware engineer now, doing ASIC chip design. My sister, I don't think, ever really, got into a technology focus at all. So I think it was really, you know, mostly just me in the earlier days, and then my rest of my siblings caught up a little bit later in life.
What did your parents do?
My father was an industrial engineer, worked for Pacific Power and Light, and my mother was a stay-at-home mom.
So at least the engineering aspect got in there from your dad a bit.
Yeah.
So was doing computer stuff something you always decided you wanted to do from seventh grade on, or?
No, I mean, for a long time I always kind of thought I'd be an engineer, and you know, probably because my father was had his degree in engineering, so I probably always thought that way. But for a long time, I thought I was going to be a mechanical engineer. You know, turned out when I got to school, I didn't really like a lot of the stuff I was going through, so switched more over towards computers, which was an interesting era back then, interesting thing back then. When I was in high school, you know, I had at least brief dreams of being a musician, a drummer, and I was a longer
fame and fortune, right?
Yeah, a little bit longer on practice and shorter on talent than I needed to be. So I think it became kind of apparent that wasn't going to work out.
But now, so like your father being an engineer and you moving to engineering, is that something you felt that direction was the right way to go, and that's why computers came into it?
Me when I was younger?
Yeah.
I think, I was got back into it again. I think it was mostly because I was just kind of interested in math and there's a tie into that and just something new and interesting. You know, when I went to school as a mechanical engineer and they made us, you know, part of the engineering, when you were in engineering school, you had to do, I believe, 4 or maybe 5 core courses in various areas before you picked out your final major. And, you know, I did mechanical and chemistry and applied physics and a couple other courses. And then computer, of course, you had to take, CS 101 and 211, I think it was back then. And really, those were the more interesting of the courses, or the ones that I was in at that point in time. You know, all of it was interesting. And again, I always kind of liked math. But that was the most interesting of the sort of core curriculum courses that I took and I kind of got into it, especially the lower layer operating systems portions of it. Really, it was much less about the theory and much more about, you know, how things work.
Mm-hmm. So when you get more into the DNA of the systems, rather than
operating systems and networking and you know, hardware software interfaces in that space, more so than, you know, complexity theory or things like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, in those days, in doing computers in high school then college, the computers were a lot simpler than they are today.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think if the computers had been the complex system there today, you wouldn't have seen quite the same need?
I think that as the systems get more complex, you need, you know, more people to work on them in some sense. We built up lots of layers of abstraction. So in some ways, I think the way you approach computers these days, if you were starting out, would be different, you know, than they were back then. I mean, we had fewer layers of abstraction, much simpler interfaces, for example. A lot of concepts are still being developed that are considered fairly commonplace now. So I think, you know, you would probably approach it differently and probably taken a different attack on it. It's interesting, you know, when I started, we had a very, you know, we sort of learned everything from the ground up. You know, here's how circuits work, here's how digital electronics work, you build up from that, here's the operating system and the application layer and things along that line. I think there's less of that probably these days, mm-hmm. and probably an earlier specialization towards, are you more of an applications guy and or a systems guy? And I think there's, you know, just probably less research happening in operating systems right now than there was back then.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that maybe changing the way kids choose their vocation then? Maybe people that should be going computers aren't, because it's not quite the same, you know, change the world at the computer level that was happening when you were going in there?
Well, I think it's, again, I think, I don't know if I see that. I see a lot more focus on and, you know, it's right. I wouldn't argue with it around, you know, web programming, web interfaces, you know, scripting languages, you know, mobile applications. You know, the world changes and computers still have a place in it. Their form changes a little bit, but it's still there. So I think, you know, I don't know that I see, I mean, Yeah, I doubt there's anybody right now who's coming into high school learning IBM 370 assembly language programming. That is probably true.
Frankly, I think they should. Teaching assembly language in high school and college would be a good idea.
No. There's probably somewhat truth to that, but I think actually, you know, it's more important to learn in some ways how the world works today, and I think the tendency towards web and scripting and mobile is probably the right thing.
Mm-hmm. So you don't think understanding those really key fundamentals, how things work underneath the covers, is still valuable? I mean, like you know, take being a chef. I mean, you still got to learn the basic sauces.
Absolutely, it's valuable. Do I think there's by no means would I say you should assume it's black magic underneath the API set, okay? You know, you kind of have to know how things work down below in order to be able to really understand the choices you make, and perf always comes up, right? I mean, it's really easy to get into a world where you call a particular API set and you assume, you know, it's cheap for whatever reason, and it's not. You have to sort of have an understanding of how the API set might work in order to make intelligent decisions about it, or else be able to read some of the stuff. But I do think the focus towards of the world has shifted to a different set of problems than existed back then.
Yeah. And if all we're doing is generating IBM 370 programmers, they wouldn't have much of a job after that, would they? In college, then, your focus was on getting a computer science degree.
Mm-hmm.
At what point in time did you realize that Microsoft is where you probably wanted to end up at?
You know, it's interesting. I grew up in Oregon. I went to high school in Oregon and really liked it there. And I ended up going back to school on the East Coast at Cornell University, which was great also. But I kind of missed the West Coast. I missed home. And so when I came out of college, I actually went to work for Intel for a couple of years, which is probably where I started studying networking, because before that I was much more of a of a hardware software low-level device driver guy, and I kind of got more into some of the networking stuff at Intel. But I spent 2 years working at Intel, and while I was working at Intel, I worked with a guy named Brian Valentine, who a lot of people know, and we became friends. And when he went to work up here, he followed Paul Moritz, who was also at Intel. He followed Paul up here to work at Microsoft, and then probably a year or two later, Brian called me up and said, "Hey, you want to come too?" And that's how I got to Microsoft, was from Intel via Brian Valentine.
Mm-hmm. And what was your first interview like then?
My first interview.
Because interviews are they're great interview stories.
Yeah, you know, I don't have, that was a long time ago. I don't know if I have any great interview stories. I remember a couple of the questions, which were really about how you move a cursor along through a DBCS strings and stuff like that, and the classic...
And by cursor, you're not talking mouse cursor.
No, no. Yeah. And then there was one about something about rotation on the dial. I don't remember that one. I remember it was all those things have faded from my memory at this point, I'm afraid.
And what was your first job?
First job, that I remember. That was working on Endis 2.1 drivers for DOS and OS2 for an Intel-based 82586 10 megabit Ethernet card.
There you go.
I remember that one very clearly.
And what was that like? Because this was in the beginnings of networking on...
Yeah, that was fun. That was fascinating, right? I mean, the Endis was a relatively new spec at that point in time. You know, we were working closely with 3Com at that point in time, Microsoft was, on some of the networking technology. Ethernet was an interesting space. I mean, we were still back in the thick coax cables and the vampire taps. We didn't have the spiffy Cat5 and the RJ45 connectors. So
we're getting rid of our Xenix terminals.
Yeah, at Microsoft. We were still on Xenix Mail back then. So that was a lot of fun. It was a growing area. It was a smaller team, and you know, just you know, basically handed a board an Endis spec and a hardware spec for the board, and say, go make a driver. You know, come back when you're done. It was pretty cool. It was a learning experience. You learned a lot about stuff they don't teach you in college, like you know, really details around how do you linear paneling properly and perf characteristics, memory characteristics. Again, those are primitive systems by today's standards. It's very low memory.
Yeah.
Memory mattered a lot, and having to really try and squeeze everything you could out was fascinating. And then I remember I sort of moved up the stack from there, and we had a networking protocol called NetBuoy, codenamed JetBuoy because there was a guy, Steve Jones, that was working on with it. And we had that was actually a lot of that was done in x86 assembly language. So the first few years at Microsoft were done, you know, in assembly language. I don't think I moved over to C at Microsoft until probably the NT days. But we'd written a bunch of this protocol stack in assembly language, and it used LLC class 2 reliable link layer, and it had a naming and framing protocol above it. And we had a budget because we were trying to beat a competitor, and we had certain perf numbers we had to hit, and we'd very carefully gone through and done basically an instruction budget. The driver could take so many instructions, and the protocol stack, the transport stack could take so many instructions, the file system could take so many instructions, the SMB server could take so many instructions. And I think our budget was like 100 instructions from between two points in the code, between the time we got the command, the time we had to hand the first packet off to the driver. And I remember getting it down to, you know, slaving and counting the instructions and getting it down to 104 and then down to 102 and trying to scrape out the last two instructions. I don't think we ever got it. But, I think in the end we made it the two instructions someplace else. But, man, just scraping through and just trying to really, you know, really optimize the code and find different ways to organize things and shake it out was a really interesting problem back then.
I think there's some interesting challenges that I think people in the same way don't quite get into these days, especially since using higher level languages like C. Mm-hmm. You know, back then, I mean, it was well known that the C compilers could not get as efficient as assembly language program, even though now you're almost more efficient with C than you are in assembly language.
Yeah.
There's still kind of a sense of accomplishment. It's almost, you know, like playing Tetris really well when you're doing assembly language programming, I think.
It was cool, but I don't miss it. I can't say I miss it, and I appreciate a good compiler and really great dev tools, actually. So.
Yeah. Okay, so after that, what did you do?
Let's see. So I was here. I worked on OS2 and a LAN manager. And then from there, we moved on towards, this is where we started to get in. I worked on the Windows for Workgroups, actually. So I think I went from that onto the Windows for Work, from the very first version of the Windows for Workgroups project. And we were spreading back then what's called VXD, which were mode device drivers for Windows, and so I worked on the protocol stack VXDs for that. We're still using a NetBIOS interface on top of that.
But like Windows Workgroups, I mean, from my memory, that was a fairly important release of Windows, because prior to that, Windows really was an island unto itself for the most part. I mean, didn't really connect network. You'd have to bump to DOS to be able to get any files off the network stack,
and it was one of the
mapping drives and so forth.
Yeah, it was one of the earlier networking-oriented efforts at Microsoft. It was a relatively small team. There were a few of us on that first version. It was cool. It was a fun time. Also, we were still in assembly language back then, but we were sort of moving into the 32-bit era out of the 16-bit code era, which was pretty cool for the time. People watching this are probably thinking, 32-bit code seem cool. 16-bit, what? And that was a lot of fun, working on that with a good group of guys. Then I left with the first version. There's a second version, which probably had more success than the first version and brought in some IPX and some network stuff. I wasn't really very involved in that one. I was off then working on our early TCP/IP efforts. So a few of us were working on a spec called WinSock, and Windows Sockets, which was born out of a interop Birds of a Feather session. Then I ended up being the guy who wrote the first from-scratch version of TCP/IP for NT, and we also ported that to Windows for Workgroups and Win95. There were earlier versions. There was something that the very first version of NT licensed a TCP stack from Spider Systems, but that didn't work out for us, and I ended up coming in and writing a from-scratch version of the TCP/IP stack. And there was another guy I was working with, Dave Treadwell, was working on the sockets layer. So he and I worked pretty closely together back then.
Mm-hmm. And TCP/IP, for the audience, people that aren't quite familiar exactly why that's important, that is essentially the backbone of the networking stack for the Internet.
It's the core protocol for reliable delivery, for the Internet. It's basically the underlying transport protocol for most communications on the Internet today.
Mm-hmm. And back in those days, the web didn't really exist for the most part. Internet was, FTP and Gopher and
And a lot of our early, efforts on the TCP/IP stuff were aimed at around interop with other workstations. Sun and others had a big TCP history, and we were very focused on interop with them.
Because Windows was still kind of a more for the home, for the most part, and so we were trying to move from that into the enterprise with Windows NT.
Correct.
And so clearly an important direction for us to go. Yeah. I mean, it's pivotal. I mean, so you got Windows Workgroups moving networking first on Windows, and then you got Windows NT and networking installed there for enterprise delivery of networking. And today, we can't even imagine using a computer that's not connected.
I mean, correct.
I'm seeing people in the airports, and if they can't find a Wi-Fi hotspot that they can get access to, I mean, they feel lost.
Yeah, and you could never have predicted that back then, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, it was it was a, that's been one of the stranger things, but seeing that evolution of stuff go forward from way we were back then. I mean, I remember there was a lot of skepticism once upon a time around whether or not TCP/IP or Microsoft would ever be a useful protocol, or whether we're better off focusing on more of enterprise connectivity protocols, SNA, and some of the other stuff. There was actually heated debates, which in hindsight looked silly, right? At the time, you know, there was a lot of questions around what's the right way to go, which one should we embrace. It wasn't as clear back then.
What do you think some of the decisions that actually, you know, changed the direction that we went from that standpoint?
What were some of the, well, deciding to actually go and bet in a large way on TCP/IP and sockets and try and really create a good implementation of those for our stuff was one of them for sure. I think WinSock, which Dave Treadwell and some other people had a lot to do with also, was actually one of the underrated shifts, because it actually enabled sort of a standardized interface to the networking layer that allowed applications to be done. I mean, before, without that, there was a time when there were TCP and a lot of TCP/IP implementations for Windows, some very good ones, in fact. But they all tended to have slightly different sockets interfaces. It was difficult to have, you know, one FTP application or one, you know, telnet application, whatever, that worked across multiple of them. So the fact that a group of people got together, and there were people from Sun and other places also who were involved in this, to create a standardized interface that actually in a lot of ways probably allowed the browsers to come into play, because before that you would have otherwise been this world where the browser was tied to the stack. And so that actually had a pretty large impact on the way the industry evolved. You know, something else would have come in its place for sure, right? You can't go back and say, "Oh, that we were geniuses." No, I mean, we did the obvious stuff, and then. But I think it was a pretty big shift at the time to actually standardize some of that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Does that mean anything? Standardizing, you know, does allow more applications to be written, because, you know, some of these applications, you look at them, they're pretty complex to access some of that stuff back in those days. I mean, I remember trying to write some of the things, and they were doing relatively simple things. Mm-hmm. And nowadays, you can do the same sort of thing in, you know, two or three lines of C# code or something.
Yeah.
Or even script code. I mean, it's amazing what, you know, JavaScript applications can do these days compared to the code we have to write in the past. So then after that, what happened?
Oh, well, so after that, let's see, you know, we decided this whole web thing was going to get big, and I was off in an incubation project for a little while called Project 42, which didn't yield a lot of direct results, but yielded a lot of indirect results for the company. The particular piece I was on was, and then I was on IIS for a while, also an information server for, I think it was IIS 3 and 4 was probably mostly where I was there on. And then I was...
Which, with IIS, you know, prior to that point, Windows NT, even though it could be a server, was not capable of being a internet or web server, because it didn't have the guts for actually serving stuff out when requests came to it for the network packets, probably.
Right. Yeah, and this was an interesting time, too, because the HTTP protocol had been created, but the first large standardization of HTTP 1.1, which formalized, you know, there was formalized some of the connection keep alive semantics and some of the other header stuff that was in there was just coming out, and so we were scrambling to try and, you know, track that standard and try and come up with a real HTTP 1.1 compliant protocol standard, which was a lot of what I was working on back then. And then I was involved in Project 42 stuff, and then there was something that came out of there, which was at the time called the Universal Listener, and it eventually became HTTP.sys, which is a device driver that does some kernel mode caching and dispatch of incoming HTTP requests to upper layer applications, and I was working on that for a while. And then I ended up going off into DevDiv for a while, working on some of the early system .NET FX stuff, system.NET classes in particular were something I was working on. And then I came back, right after Win2K shift, I came back into Windows and worked in the networking group there. Again, I kind of picked up some of the old TCP stuff and NDIS stuff, and then more and more stuff, larger and larger managerial responsibilities throughout that. And I was basically in networking again from 2000-ish until 2009, more or less, until when I went over to Windows Phone.
Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking about, you know, like switching from the pre.NET days to the post.NET days, and you're still doing network stack programming.
I like networking.
You like networking. I mean, to me, it seems like, you know, the big debate from 2000 on has been, you know, managed code versus unmanaged code.
Yeah.
I would think networking stacks is something that doing and manage code would be relative difficult. It's a system-level application, system-level code that needs more of the unmanaged capabilities. What do you think?
I don't know if I try and write a low-layer reliable delivery protocol in managed code, although a lot of people have and are still doing it. You know, some of the upper-layer stuff, HTTP protocols, completely reasonable. Especially client-side HTTP protocols, is completely reasonable to write in managed code.
It's easier, quite a bit easier.
Yeah. And there's always a trade-off between, are you getting the absolute maximum performance out of something versus simplicity and ease of development? I mean, simple code is simple. Simple code is typically more robust code. Now, sometimes code can look simple, and what you're really doing is hiding a bunch of side effects under macros or overrides or stuff, and that's not helpful. But in general, if you can write code simply and easily, it's more likely to be robust than it is if you're writing super, super, super complex code.
Yeah. So it's almost like the difference between assembly code and C code versus managed code and unmanaged code. Managed code is simpler to write. It's easier to write. Maybe you don't have the same level to some underlying infrastructure at the hardware level you might want. Same thing with, I think, with some level.
Yeah. Well, the managed code perf these days is pretty good. I'm not going to fight the perf wars anymore.
Yeah. it's all semantics what you work on from that standpoint. And so from there you go to Windows Phone.
Yes, in 2009-ish, I believe, early in 2009.
And as I was watching your career, I'm seeing you coming through key points where we've made these almost evolutionary decisions about what we're doing with Windows, adding networking to the original 16-bit Windows, Windows NT, IIS, getting the Internet Server capable of running on top of it. I mean, each one of these things, I think, have moved Windows further. And now Windows Phone is... Myself, I think it's one of the key things we're working in right now that's actually going to advance Windows, both from the handheld device we're using, as well as just, I think, the Windows operating system, mm-hmm. and making them all work together better.
Yeah, I got crappy timing, huh? I think it's been interesting to see a lot of the stuff happen, and be involved in a little bit of some of it. I mean, the phone experience has been great, a great challenge to come in and sort of... tackle a big, hard problem. I mean, I've spent a lot of my career working in areas and businesses that Microsoft is quite successful in, right? And coming in and being in a position of being behind is an entirely different experience. And having to try and establish a culture and institute some planning and reliability and pride almost in some ways is super important. It's a lot of fun.
So what exactly are you doing for the Windows Phone Group right now?
I'm the... head of development, software development. So all of the software engineers who write code directly for the phone and they're not part of the partner teams report up through me. And, we have a number of partner teams, Office and Live and Dev, and a bunch of others. I don't want to list names because I'll forget somebody. But all their code also comes in through the tree my team owns.
Mm-hmm. And so you're focusing on the development aspects?
Yeah, software development.
Watching the applications work properly, making sure they're all structured internally.
Yeah, there's three people, way we're structured. We report to Terry Meyerson, and then there are three people who are sort of on the client side of things. There's me, and I run the software development. There's Joel Belfiore, who's program management, and Darren Laybourne, who runs test. And we form a trio, and we work together to build the phone. And to a first approximation, you can think of it as Joel being the guy who thinks about the what. He's sort of the program manager and tries to set the direction for design and the vision development and user experience and things like that. My responsibilities are much more in the how area, right? I am responsible for figuring out how we build something and what the right architecture is, execution, scheduling, the engineering details.
The undercover guy.
sort of. And then Darren Laybourne, my peer, is the test guy, and he's responsible at some level. If you're going to say how and what, then he'd be sort of when, right? He's responsible for quality, helping figure out when we're going to ship, and also doing a lot of the execution load.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we think about Windows Phone, we've got to think about Windows Mobile ahead of that and the big switch we had to make.
Yeah.
Were you involved in that switch at all, or did you come in after the switch happened?
I was not involved in Windows 6 Mobile 6.5 or before. I came in right as the switch was happening. So Terry came over in, I guess, October-ish of 2008, and then I followed him over in early 2009. Mm-hmm. And that was just the beginning of the switch. We had just sort of decided that there was going to be a new break, and we're going to come up with a new UI, a new set of principles around end user and design, and you know, more of a formalization of the chassis specs, some tweaks to the way we were engaging with the OEMs previously. And so all that was happening as I came over. And then we had a huge reorg come on as at the time also. So
those always happen like that.
Yeah, they always do. Yeah.
Now, and since you're more of an engineer, where Joe and stuff is going to be more the kind of the UI guy, you're really not dealing much with the pixels on screen, per se. You're dealing with the technology that powers those pixels?
Well, yeah. I'm thinking of a quote Leshway says about me. My team produces all of the UI frameworks and actually gets all the pixels on screen. And certainly a lot of the developers on my team actually engage with the designers, the graphic designers, and the program managers who are doing the overall UI design. But my team does not, you know, do the initial storyboarding necessarily. But we iterate with the graphic designers and the program managers, and then we build the UI frameworks and the vending mechanisms and the animation engines and mm-hmm. graphics drivers and things like that are needed to actually put the UI on the screen.
Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of people, when they're looking at whether it's, you know, Windows Phone or Windows itself or the Macintosh or the iPhone, quite often I think they get over-glamorized by what they're seeing on the screen, the flow of pixels, the movement, the mm-hmm. the artwork almost.
That's the cool stuff.
That's the cool stuff, but it's not what's doing the work. I mean, the work's happening under the covers. It almost doesn't matter what it looks like functionally other than the way the interface is between the human and the machine.
Well, I mean, I think, I don't know. I think actually how it looks matters a lot, because you have to engage the end user, right? I mean, you have to hold their attention, and it has to feel natural and smooth to them. You don't want to create a sense of cognitive dissonance where they're, you know, I sometimes would say it's the principle of least surprise. You never want to surprise the user. The you know, sometimes there's no way to predict, but you still want to surprise them the least, and you don't want to have a user interface where the end user is like, what the heck happened here, right? And, you know, where did that come from? So I think, and you know, I would never undervalue the value of the smooth animations, the really flowing feeling. I know how hard it is to build all that. I know what went through and the undercovers to actually make all that smoothness and get the input latency in the touch sensor in the touch pipeline down low and do a really great job on the touch drivers. So some very talented people on my team work really, really hard to make all that happen. So it's great stuff, and I think the end result is, you know, we're quite proud of it. I mean, it's a beautiful design and flows really well and looks great, and I think it's easy to use, which is half the battle. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. you always want people to use your stuff. If you're going to build something, you want people to use it, and for it to be used, it has to be easy to use, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I'm comfortable with the command line. I'm kind of that kind of guy in a lot of ways, all right? I still use VI as an editor. Half the people watching just shook their heads in despair. you know, I also recognize that that's not, you know, not what most people are going to do, and that we actually need to have the really great flowing UI out there to capture people's hearts.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And provide that interface. Because, like, back in the days when we grew up with computers, I mean, the people using computers were the geeks, the people that almost enjoyed that challenge of taking and mastering the machine, where, you know, your parents, they didn't want to master the machine.
Right.
They wanted to be the master of the machine and have it right. work for them.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. There's a tendency as engineers to think in terms of, to believe that end users have a mental model of the machine. Because oftentimes an engineer will, or somebody familiar with computers or software will sort of implicitly construct sort of this mental model of a machine and say, well, the state machine internally must be something like this, so therefore if I do that, it'll work. And oftentimes they're right. It turns out, I think a lot of end users don't really have that. I mean, if they don't have that background into them, it's more magic. It's more like, I know I've learned over some period of time that if I click X and then Y and then Z, this will happen. And so the trick is actually to make that feel natural, so they don't have to build a mental model up that it feels like something that they would expect it to behave. You don't want them to hold a phone and think it's a computer, right? Yeah. You want them to hold a phone and have it feel like a phone, or have it feel like an app, or have them feel like it's a useful tool for finding directions, or for posting my status, or engaging with my friends.
Mm-hmm. Just do the natural thing. I mean, it's like, you know, where computer programmers might think like computers to a certain extent, people really want the computers to think like them, And I think that's kind of the challenge, probably. Is make computers interface with the individual.
Yeah, probably.
The other way around, which I think we're probably a ways off from that. But
yeah, we get better. I mean, lots of great people doing great design on this stuff. So. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And from the design standpoint, your team is providing that functionality by making those systems easier for application to interface with. Getting the networking stack, for example, something you need. You write a C-sharp code in three lines of code, access the network stack.
Yeah, there's a lot that goes underneath that. You know, and my team does everything from the operating system, the networking, to device drivers, to the touch pipeline, gesture recognition, you know, animation frameworks, UI scripting engines, and all, you know, everything all the way up and down the stack. So pretty much somebody in my team works with outside of my team. The team is involved in almost all of the stuff that shifts in RAM on the phone, and you know we're also responsible for the in conjunction with DevDiv and a lot of other partners outside of the team, Yamanote and application development frameworks. And we pick up the XNA framework from our friends over in IEB, and that's great. And you know DevDiv does a lot of great work for Silverlight, which we also pull up on that one. We integrate all that in the phone and do a bunch of tooling work to present a great developer experience.
Mm-hmm. Now, how much of the phone model are you taking and relying upon some of your past experiences with Windows and Windows NT and OS 2 and so forth?
The phone,
or is it a different? I mean, like you know, it's not a computer; it's a phone.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the UI, and there are thematic elements, in the UI across a lot of our projects. Joe Belfiore worked on Media Center before that, and I can look at Media Center and see elements of the design of the Media Center UI in the phone. So certainly that carries forward. If the stuff I think about in terms of Windows, you know, we brought over parts of the Windows culture and parts of the Windows engineering system, and we're looking more and more as we go forward to leverage more and more common code across the company. The browser we have in our upcoming release of the Windows Phone is basically the same source code as IE9, and we're now moving onto a shared code base with them and doing more and more of that going forward. So there's that in there. And then, you know, I think over time, I think you'll see more and more common thematic design elements across a number of Microsoft products.
Now, how hard is it to share code? I mean, I'd almost think that, I mean, the phone has to be a less powerful computer than my laptop is.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that's difficult. The phone runs ARM, and a lot of the Windows code runs x86, so that's starting to change. And it's a less powerful chip. We're actually on a different kernel. I mean, we're running Windows Phone 7, and our updating upcoming release are based on Windows CE as opposed to the Windows kernel. And so you're having a little bit of cross-platform porting challenges there. Different timelines make it difficult. Different teams releasing at different timelines and different timelines and different milestones makes it difficult. It's a very valuable thing to do when you can make it work. You get a lot of leverage in common code. You don't have to repeat the same mistakes. You don't have to fix the same security vulnerabilities. You can, you know, if you spend a lot of time tuning battery or performance, which can be a lot of time, it gets leveraged across more places than just one. That's great. So there's a lot of value to it, but it can be quite difficult.
So you're almost saying that learning is bidirectional, though, because what you're doing on the Windows Phone can move its way into regular Windows.
I think so. Yeah.
I think power management, I think, is a good point there. Like, power management phone is extremely important, and not quite as important for a laptop, but if we can get the laptops
pretty important. I think we're just stepping down that direction. I think that will be true. I think we're just beginning to go that direction.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what do you see the future for Windows Phone? I mean, do you see it as getting a more like a computer size-wise, or do you think maintaining this smaller footprint is kind of going to be important?
You know, I think we're a phone, and I think we're going to stay a phone. And I think it's important to remember that even though your phone does a lot of things, it's still a phone. It's still got to make a phone call. It's still got to be able to text message, and you have to do your email and everything else. So and I think you'll see phones vary in form factor, and we'll support that also. I've seen phone designs that are, 4.3 to 4.5-inch screens. I think there's probably some upper limit on our screen size where our phone UI doesn't look as good at certain screen sizes as it might if you actually tweak the UI, and you know we're not really thinking in that direction right now. But you know, I think primarily we're going to stay as a phone, and we'll support a variety of different screen sizes and over time resolutions and stuff, but we're basically a phone.
It's almost funny to hear you talk about resolutions like that. I mean, if I remember back in the early days when I started using my computers, I mean, you know, EGA and CGA resolutions. I mean, my watch probably has, well, not this watch, has a higher resolution than my computer screens does. And as I think, my phone right now has far more resolution.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot packed into the into a modern smartphone in terms of horsepower and screens, even, you know, network bandwidth, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you're getting fairly good network download speeds these days. So.
And your job is to eke every single bit of performance you can out of that.
Yeah, it's one of them. Power and battery life is everything. Networking utilization, all those things are super, super important.
Now, do you think you're pushing hardware design or hardware is advancing and you're doing what you can to utilize what they put into it?
That's a great question. I think there's some of both on this one. I mean, you know, certainly hardware is evolving very rapidly, and you see trends towards both, you know, really big, powerful phones, dual core, quad core, you know, and there's certainly interest in trying to figure out what a phone would do with all that horsepower. At the same time, there's a move towards lower end, taking smartphones down to lower price points. Battery life is always important. You know, one of the more common complaints people will have about a smartphone, almost any smartphone, in fact, is the battery is, you know, I have to charge it too often, right? I've never met somebody yet who would say, no, my battery, you know, I wouldn't be happy if I had a little more battery time on my phone. So I think there's, you know, there's always a tension here between, so on the one hand, phones are getting bigger and more powerful, and you want to be able to scale, support those, and, you know, support the great, really interactive gaming scenarios I think you're going to start to see on phones. At the same time, you know, look at the market as it goes down and say, you know, still want to be able to have a really great experience on a 256 megabyte phone running a relatively low power processor because it's cheaper. And, you know, if you can get a cheaper phone out more broadly, then you're going to address more people and more people will use your software.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, in talking about the capabilities of the phone, I mean, it also brings in the capabilities that we're putting into the operating system. And it's almost like a constantly evolving path that we're going down. I mean, we're coming out with Windows Phone 7. I mean, we had a line in the sand to a certain extent. We needed to make sure we came out with a product. I'm sure there were designs that were beyond that line in the sand. How do you deal with that?
How you deal with design? Well, I mean, you know, our goal with Windows Phone 7 was real simple. We were going to ship a phone we were proud of, right? I mean, that was the mantra we had, which was ship a phone that you're proud of. By holiday, but ship a phone that you're proud of, first of all. And we focus really hard on that. It's always the case that there's more ideas that you have than you'll be able to be able to deliver. I mean, shipping is a choice in a lot of ways. Shipping is a decision that you make, and you say, okay, this is what we're going to do, and, you know, we want to have a rational plan and build something that we know we can deliver on and deliver it in a timely fashion. I'm a big believer in the difference between an aspiration and a plan. This is something my team will hear from me a lot is, you know, you don't have a plan. People say, I have a plan. Like, no, you don't have a plan. You have an aspiration. A plan has name, dates, and numbers, and you know how to resource it, and you figured out the contingencies, and you've got, you know, the details behind it. An aspiration is, you know, yeah, it sure would be great if we could do that. And so we always have more aspirations than we can build a plan for in a timely fashion. And, you know, what typically happens then is you just say there's only so much we're going to get done, and you want to have whatever you do build be end-to-end complete or end-to-end coherent. You don't want to do a whole bunch of half-finished features, right? You want to be able to say, here's something that works completely through end-to-end and has, you know, meaty user impact to it. And whatever you don't get to next time, you look at for next time. And sometimes you're happy you missed it, right? Sometimes you're like, boy, we could have built that and we would have looked stupid because the market shifted, so I'm glad we didn't. Sometimes your initial idea is still valid and you pick it up next time and enhance on it. And sometimes, you know, it just turns out to be just difficult enough that you're never going to really build it in a timely fashion. So, yeah, we definitely had things in 7 that we wanted to build, couldn't quite get there, copy and paste being the most famous one, right? And then we did an update to add that one.
I mean, like, take copy and paste, for example. I mean, it's something that we knew we had to have it in the product. It's not that we just kind of think, oh, we forgot copy and paste, and so we added it later on. We knew that needed to be there. And yet we chose to draw the line in the sand prior to that being able to be added to it. Is that all part of the trade-offs of what needs to be done to the product?
It's a trade-off. And that's, you know, that was actually a subject of hot debate as to whether or not we needed it or not and how much end users used it and how much was just, you know, a checkbox feature, right? And so I think it was a painful thing not to have, and we put it back in as fast as we could. That sort of stuff always happens, right? I mean, the number of hot debates you'll have over a topic that in hindsight, you know, it's hard to keep perspective sometimes, and it's useful to say, is what we're arguing about right now really going to matter in 3 years, right? Or would we look back in 3 years and say, that's a pointless discussion to be having. You guys are missing the big picture.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's always that question around whether or not this particular feature or that particular feature is worth slipping a release for, or whether it's got to make the cut and move on. I mean, again, it really is just being conscious and making these decisions. You know, I don't feel bad about a feature that we think about and decide that we don't want to do for whatever reason. Even if we're wrong, if we make a bad decision, I don't feel bad about that as long as we thought about it. What I feel bad about is the ones which you just miss, right? Where you're like, oh my God, we didn't do that. We didn't even think about doing that. That's the ones where you're like, oh, that's when you feel stupid, right? You know, if you look at a decision, you have a good debate about it, you decide not to do something, you know it's painful. There are some sort of features which, no matter what you do, somebody's going to be unhappy. Either you're going to do it and people think it clutters things up, or if you don't do it, people are going to be mad that you don't have it. And so sometimes you're just going to look at something and move forward. But it's the ones where you just miss it that kill you.
Yeah, because, you know, at least otherwise, you've had that conversation.
Right.
And so you know why you chose one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. Now, with Mango, because we're ongoing releases, we had the original Windows Phone 7, they had the Noto update, now we got the Mango version coming forward. Was there an awful lot of work that you guys did after the Noto to get Mango done?
Oh, yeah, it's huge. We've been busy. There's a lot of work. There's a lot of good features in Mango. There's a lot of stuff coming into it. And, you know, it's been a big pile of work for a lot of the team to get that much done.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, basically, there was not a lot of downtime from the time we shipped 7 until the time we're shipping Mango. It was kind of, we got 7 done, signed off on it, you know, took a couple months to plan, dived into it again.
So it's all just a constantly moving train as far as you guys are concerned.
Yeah, well, we're behind. I mean, you know, when you're behind, you got to try and catch up.
Mm-hmm. But we're caught up now, aren't we?
I mean, we face some tough competition. Yeah, there's some very good phones out there.
It's quite frankly, it's not just the phone we're competing against, but it's also the computers out there too. People are used to doing something on their computer, and if they see their phone as being kind of an extension of their computer, they almost expect that to work kind of in the same fashion.
Well, we would say the phone is not a computer, right? I mean, we kind of did, you know, there was the choice. You could have made a choice to say, we'll try and put more of a Windows-like, you know, UI in the phone. And we explicitly didn't want to do that. We tried to make it more personal, more about you, you know, integrate more of your experiences. And that's what we continue to do with Mango, was try and integrate more experiences into the phone and give it a more personal experience. So I think, in some extent, I don't think of the, I mean, you were correct in the phone as a computer from a technology point of view, and certainly when you think about how you build it underneath, you have to consider how you're going to converge some of that stuff. From a user experience point of view, I think, you know, I don't know if I would, I don't know that we would look and say that, you know, feature foo is now existing on PCs, so therefore feature foo needs to exist in the phone. I mean, you might, but it's not necessarily a driving point for us.
I assume then there's a lot of work that now that Mango is almost ready to come out.
Yeah.
There's a lot of work that you see beyond that line of the sand. Anything you can tell me about?
Nope.
I can turn the microphones off if you want.
Nope.
I mean, because I think that's what users are always excited about, is seeing what's going on, and because they want to see what their next version of their phone is
going
to be like.
There's a lot of great stuff going on, and it's going to be great.
Yeah.
That's all I can say.
Well, I mean, I really appreciate the time we spent. But before we let you go, there's a few questions I'd like to ask all of my guests to kind of help set the level amongst the audience and reveal the inner Henry, if you will.
There is no inner Henry.
It's all a facade.
It's all a facade.
Yeah. So the first question is, what book would you like to recommend everyone read?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I don't know if there's exactly one book. You know, I recommended to my wife one time that she read Soul of a New Machine because I thought that would help explain, and you know, sort of what I do to her, and I think she never did it. Hi, Vicky. There's a lot of other, you know, a lot of the good books. The obvious choices would be, you know, Lord of the Rings or something like that, because, you know, geeks. But I think, you know, probably I'd go with Hamlet.
In the original Klingon, of course.
No. You know, I'm actually a big fan of that play. There's a lot of great quotes in that book, and you know, I'm oftentimes amazed when people will quote Hamlet without knowing that they're doing it. And it also got me through high school AP English. So
there really?
You go, Hamlet. Yeah.
There you go. Yeah.
I wrote an essay on it. So
is there something specific you like about Hamlet? Just,
you know, I like the whole. Like, as I said, I like the language. I like the way it flows. I like the tragedy aspects of it. I mean, especially, you know, when you know how it plays out. There's a certain, I don't know. No, you know, I can give you a Chris Spencer on that one. I just like the book.
Yeah, because I think a lot of people, they know of Hamlet, but I think very few people have actually read Hamlet, much less maybe even seen any of the actual movies or plays based on it.
Yeah, well, you should.
Yeah. So, or read the Cliff Notes anyway.
Yeah, read the Cliff Notes, thanks. No, save that for Catcher in the Rye or something.
Okay. Or War and Peace.
Yeah, War and Peace.
So my second question is, if you weren't working in the computer industry, what do you think you'd be doing?
Yeah, I'd like to think I'd have taken a shot at being a musician. As I said, I think I might have been longer on time and practice and shorter on talent. So I probably would have tried for had failing that, you know, and probably would have, you know, and you know, might have ended up as a high school music teacher, which is a great profession too. I mean, so that could have been a possibility. Or yeah, beyond that, I don't know. I mean, something in math might have gone on and worked on a PhD in math or something.
Mm-hmm. Do you still do music at all now, or?
A little bit. I'm trying to teach my son to play a little bit, and he's kind of getting into it.
Drums.
I listen to a lot of music, so.
Yeah. And how's your son doing?
Good. For an 8-year-old. Yeah. 9-year-old now. He's very good.
So he's going to be the pro musician of the family.
It could be.
Your other kids getting any music at all? Flutophone, perhaps?
Flutophone? No, my younger son's thinking of wanting to play drums also, but he hasn't really started yet, and my daughter is not showing any interest yet.
Do they still do flutophones?
I don't even know what a flutophone is, so no.
The third question is, what do you feel is the most important technology in today's world?
Phones, obviously. The most important technology, you know, the things I'm probably most excited about, it actually kind of is phones and mobility, or I might say it's a form of wireless networking, the various forms of wireless networking that are coming out. You know, what I think is interesting
Forms of wireless networking. I mean,
The wireless WAN technologies, LTE, that's coming out, and some of the white space stuff that's coming out as we reclaim bands in the U.S. What I think is really interesting is there are a lot of people out there, hundreds of millions, maybe more people, who are going to experience the Internet first and maybe only on a cell phone. I mean, most of us grew up using the Internet or learned to use the Internet on a PC or a laptop or something else, or a mainframe, whatever you learned on. But more and more there are people out there who was only first experience with the Internet and maybe only one ever is going to be from some form of smartphone. And I think that's just fascinating. I think that's really going to be hugely impactful. And as you see, the mobile computing and the various ways of wirelessly connecting people, it's going to be just hugely impactful to the world.
Now, when you're accessing the Internet via your cell phone, do you think from an experience standpoint you're still interacting with the Internet? The Internet might be powering the data models going back and forth. When I think of the Internet on PC, I've got the browser up. Nowadays, it's the browser. Yeah. It used to be an FTP window that I'd open up or something like that, or Telnet.
To what extent, you know, if you phrase accessing the Internet as via a browser, then you could ask to what extent do the applications that are on all the smartphones sort of mask that browser, right? Do they provide a sort of front end or a customized version or however you care to think of it of the Internet to people? And that's true. I mean, that really is an interesting question, which is, apps as apps come on and basically all websites produce some version of a mobile app, to what extent does that impact things? And, mm-hmm. I think the web standard, it's hard to beat the web, as the saying goes, right? I mean, the web standard is going to keep evolving and get more and more powerful. There's an interesting tension going on between apps and HTML5 and other forms of web expression. So that'll play out also. It'll be interesting to see. But, I mean, my thing that I think is really interesting about it, the stuff that I get really interested in is the way people sort of connect with, whether they call it webs or however you think the web or however you think of it, via the phone more than via PC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, like on the contact list on the phone, just by swiping it over, I'm able to see all the Facebook feed updates, and now I guess with Mango, the Twitter feed updates that the people in my phone have done. But it doesn't really feel like I'm interacting with the web, even though it is the web that's powering everything underneath it. I mean, it doesn't really feel like that.
Yep. But, the fact that you can do that from your phone, you have a point of reference there in that you've done it on something else. There will be a lot of people, whether it's our phone or some other phone, who's only ever done it that way and don't really know any other way. That's just going to change how we think about stuff.
Yes. 10 years from now, who knows?
Yep.
Which brings my next question,
which
is 25 years from now, what new technology would you like to see available?
That's a tough one because I've been in this field for, more than coming up in 25, maybe more than 25 years now. And I think if you'd asked me when I first came out of college that question, I would have predicted nothing.
Except the Internet. You would have predicted the Internet,
no,
right?
No idea. Yeah, I have no idea. Who knows what I might have said? Maybe I don't know. Who knows? I mean, it would have been I would probably totally got the wrong. I think the things that I get interested in, or I think I might be looking at, and honestly, obviously, some of this is going to be biased towards where I currently work on and what I think about day to day, is you know, what going forward more towards more natural human interaction models with computers. So speech recognition, phones that talk to you or speak to you, and you speak to them in a very natural language rather than, as you said, swiping. The swiping in the flowing user interface is cool and it's beautiful and I love it. But, you know, we have some stuff in Mango where you can actually, you know, issue voice commands and text, and that's really nice. And I can see that going forward to get more and more natural, more and more idiomatic. And that could be very cool. It could happen sooner than 25 years. And I think there are other forms of human-computer interfaces that you might see, you know, overlays and virtual reality overlays and stuff like that I've seen a lot of thinking around, which I think could really change how you think about computers. And you think less about computers or devices as a discrete element of your life, but rather just a piece of your life that flows together.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just thinking about, you know, the voice recognition and commands coming in the future of the phones. Not to be too geeky, but it kind of reminds me of on Star Trek Next Generation where they have this little phone thing. So right now we think of a phone as a display. Does it need a display? What if it, you know, was on my watch and I could just do, you know, what's the weather in San Francisco right now? And that's not only using my phone, voice recognition, but also the internet to get that.
Or a cloud or something like that, yeah.
So for the last one, we're going to actually let you exercise some of your artistic talents.
Or lack thereof.
And we'd like to have you draw and then explain your favorite data structure and be sure to sign it.
Sure. So this is a really bad diagram of an open hash table. You know, presumably we'd have a hash function up here, right? You say, or something. You know, this is an open hash table used commonly for taking a value, hashing it down to an index, into a table, and then you search through this linear list trying to find the matching element. The reason it's my favorite, I guess, is kind of every time I've tried to have a special purpose data structure or something to actually outdo one of these, I almost always end up going back and finding out that assuming I have enough memory and a good hash function, it wins. So an open hash table, it's my favorite.
And hash tables around for almost forever, it seems like.
Yep, that's right. Classic.
Hey, well, thanks, Henry, from the Technical Community Network for being our guest today. And we hope all of you enjoy this chance to look at the technology and the person behind the code.